morning. We want to welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room this morning, and a special welcome to students from O'Keefe Middle School. Would they please stand? We're delighted to have you, and we had your classmates yesterday, and we'll have some more at every session today. You've cleared out O'Keefe. It's good to see you all. You may be seated. The school is here. We have a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from private schools, public schools, and homeschool people who accept our invitation to come. They have sent materials about the proceedings, and at noon they meet with a justice assigned for that day to meet with the students, and the discussion is on the procedure, not the substance and or substantive issues of the cases. And today I am the justice assigned, so I will see you again after the second hearing today. Let me introduce the court to you all. I've already introduced myself. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm, again, if you've forgotten, Shirley Abrahamson. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the first case. I should ask if is anyone here interested in receiving a copy of a summary of the case we are about to hear. If you are, raise your hand, and the marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to understand the case if you've got a summary of the facts and law. Did the O'Keefe students not get a summary?
Looks like they all want it.
When she comes back in, I'll tell her. It may be, Mr. Pond, that everybody, all the O'Keefe students, need these. While they're being distributed, I'm going to call our first case, which is 97AP3862, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Nancy A. Schlieve. Ms. Schlieve will be representing herself. She has 25 minutes if she wants it to argue. And Mr. Attorney Wayne A. Arnold has 30 minutes. And then, Ms. Schlieve, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, Ms. Schlieve. Attorney Schlieve.
I'm told I'm short, so you might have a hard time hearing me. Can you hear me?
That's fine.
Today we are here, as the Chief Justice said, on my petition for reinstatement. My license was suspended due to medical incapacity, and I requested that it be reinstated. There are, do you want me to do a factual background?
Schlieve, you can handle this as you wish. I should advise you that the entire court, of course, got a copy of your brief as well as Mr. Arnold's brief, and that we work on the presumption everyone has read it, and you have been here before. You can assume some familiarity by the court, but how you want to spend your 25 minutes is for you. It seems to me the issue you want to raise is that the disability for which you were suspended has been, quote, cured or in remission, and that therefore, as I read your argument, you think you're entitled to be reinstated. Now, if that's not a fair summary, as I intended it to be, but you should feel free to correct it.
No, that is correct. I believe there are two issues that need to be addressed. The first one is, has the medical incapacity been removed? And the medical incapacity was alcoholism. I have not had any alcohol in 9 years. There have been three doctors, all who agree that the medical incapacity has been removed. So that is the first question, has that been removed? The second question is a bit harder, is that am I fit to return to the practice of law? And what we need to look at is, what is fitness? In this case, fitness is, did the medical incapacity make me unable to practice law? It's not the same as fitness in the a disciplinary action. This is a medical incapacity. They're two very separate kinds of actions. In this one, there are just the two questions. Is the incapacity removed, and am I fit to practice law? What we need to look at as far as fitness is, all attorneys have to meet the same standards. The court found this in the reinstatement of George, said that everyone needs to meet the same standards. So if somebody is fit under a disciplinary, then they're fit under a medical incapacity. It's not a higher standard. And in this case, I think I have demonstrated by, oh, and the standard of proof is clear and convincing.
Who has the burden on that?
I have the burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that I am fit to practice law. And what fitness would be is that I can be recommended to people, that I could handle their case in an appropriate manner. And I think that just this whole procedure shows what I am capable of doing. I filed a petition, drafted, filed, and argued motions. I've called witnesses, I've presented evidence, and I've drafted briefs. These are all things that are expected of an attorney, and they were all things that I have done. In medical incapacity cases, there are actually very few of them. Two of them in the last 15 years that have come up requesting that the license be reinstated are Kirshner and Chavez. Kirshner did not have to prove fitness. Chavez did prove fitness. The court found that Chavez was fit after he presented evidence from doctors, other attorneys. Mr. Chavez testified for himself. And they found, based on that, that he was fit to practice law. In the case at hand, I had two doctors who said that I have not had any alcohol in, it's 9.5 years now. It was 8.5 last year when this was actually heard. And I have attended all of the treatment they have requested. I have attended AA as they requested. I have had even hair testing to show that I have had no alcohol in that amount of time. And therefore, for these reasons, I submit that I am fit to practice law. In the case at hand, a medical incapacity is not supposed to be adversarial. It is supposed to be just proof we want to be shown that the person with the medical incapacity, that it has been removed. They're not saying they're a bad person. I don't have to prove things under 22.
Ms. Schlieve,
yes?
If I can interrupt you. One of the things as I read this material was that I didn't see anyone disputing that you have been alcohol-free for a long time, whether it's 8 years or 9 years or six, it's been a long time.
Correct.
And that at that length of time, the number of people who go back to that drug of choice is less than 10%, if I read this correctly.
That's correct.
But there was some tests that were done on you that showed another drug, not alcohol, right?
Yes.
And that, at least as I read this material, that was twice found, and that without an explanation that people accepted, that they're worried, as I read this, that you have just substituted a different drug.
Well, actually, what happened, the second test came back. It's a medication that I use for pain in my arm. I had a legitimate the doctor gave me a prescription, and that prescription is in evidence. That is what it was. The prescription I was given to me when I was in India, and obviously the doctor from India, I couldn't bring him over and say that that's where it came from. I think that it's important to look at that medication in that the Wislap didn't talk to my doctor about it, wasn't really concerned about it, didn't want me to do something in addition to it when I explained that it was a medication I got from a doctor in India. And as I stated, as soon as I knew that this was a medication that needed some kind of prescription, I went to my doctor who prescribed that medication. And as I said, the medication is in the record that I do take it with a prescription. And my doctor follows me very closely. He's been my doctor for 15 years, so he was with me through all of my problems, and he understands it. And he watches me very closely, and in fact, I have an appointment on the 12th.
Ms. Schlieve, how long did you practice law before there was a medical incapacity suspension?
I graduated from law school in 1990, and the medical incapacity was 97.
So you practiced for about
six or seven years? 6 or 7 years, yes.
What was the nature of your practice?
I started off as a public defender, and then I went into private practice. Although I did mostly criminal and commitment cases.
Have you kept up in any way with continuing legal education?
Yes. I've taken, I had a pass that you can take as many CLE classes as you wanted. And so during that time, I took as many classes as I could in lots of different areas because I found that they overlap. And so you sometimes something in a trust in the states can have information for another one. So I took every possible class that I could take. And when you have this kind of pass, you can take as many as you want. So anything I could take, I did take.
When you say pass, is that what you're referring to as you pay a lump sum amount and then you can take, when you make a payment, you can take all the classes you want?
Yes. I can't remember what it's called. It's called an auto pass or something. And because the classes mostly are on the Internet, you can take them you can take them whenever you want. Well, not whenever you want, when they have them, but then they will replay them. So if you miss a part of it, you can go back and listen to the part that you didn't understand. A couple of them are you go to the place and they teach it there. But they also have past classes that you can take in addition to something that's current. And I enjoy the law, so I enjoy learning about it. And it has done me a great deal of good to see. Obviously, in the last 10 years, 15 years, law has changed. And especially with computers and stuff, it's really important to keep up on the different ways you can access the information.
Counselor, if you have been practicing law since 1997, how have you supported yourself all that time?
Well, I have a rental property, and that's what I use, the money from the rental property. I live with my mother, and I help there, too, and that's how I support myself at this time. However, I am opening a tea shop starting Monday. I'm moving in this weekend, and so I'm hoping that that will bring in additional income for me.
A tea shop?
Tea shop, yes.
Sell tea?
It's tea the experience, not tea the drink. So I make sandwiches and pastries, and I have little girl tea parties and things like that. So it doesn't... and that's starting on... Well, this weekend I'm moving in, actually, on it.
If your license were restored, what kind of law would you want to practice? Criminal law again?
Actually, the law that I'm interested in is two kinds of law. One is adoption law. I did some volunteer work both in Egypt and in Thailand, and both places I met people that I would like to help. They have children that need to be adopted. And I know people here who are looking for people, would like to adopt. And that would be something I'd be very interested in helping to facilitate, that kind of thing. The other thing would be immigration for these same people. That because I know them and I know what they've gone through, it's very important to me that they get the opportunities that they can, that are available for them. I think that one thing that's important that should be looked at in both the, well, in the medical incapacity portion of this, in this case, in 1990, and I believe I attached it to a brief, there was a study done that said, talked about what somebody who had a medical incapacity, how it should be treated. And I think that it makes sense that it be treated in a way that you want to help, you want to protect the public, which is the point of a medical incapacity, but you also want the attorney to be able to practice law. And if you look at the legal system, there is a great deal of substance abuse, alcohol abuse, among attorneys, and so that people need that kind of assistance. And I think that the current system is not working for these people. If you look at WISLAP, who is supposed to be the one that deals with this, they have a very low rate of success. When I was researching it, they had one case. I'm not sure what is happening now. But because lawyers are high stress, more lawyers are having the problem with alcohol and drugs. I think that this is something that really needs to be addressed, and addressed before it gets to a point where they are harming their clients. And so I think this is something that needs to be looked into. I did receive an email on Monday that said that WISLAP is changing their program, but that's all I know about it. Because I'm not in the program, I'm not sure what exactly they're doing. The other thing is with medical incapacity, once you have, two things. One, it is difficult to find a job if you have your license taken away for medical incapacity. And with the internet, all you do is type in somebody's name and they come up, they're suspended for medical incapacity. It's difficult to find a job. And I think that what needs to be done is people need to look and say the medical incapacity has been removed. In this case, it's taken 2 years from the time I filed a petition to the time we get here. And I think that the system needs to be able to react better to the situation. If somebody has done what they're supposed to, gone into treatment, is taken care of it, it should be a speedier process than this. In the instance in my case, it took OLR 6 months to even request my medical records. So, and then to get into oral arguments, it took me 4 months to get into oral arguments. So I think that...
Counselor, have you developed any kind of a relationship with another lawyer who practices in the area of adoption or immigration law that you could have consultations with on the work that you're thinking of doing?
I have not a lawyer, an organization. It's Lutheran Social Services in Eau Claire. And they do a lot of adoption law. It's not an attorney, though. And that's something that's really needed because adoption attorneys tend to be in the bigger cities. And so in a place like Eau Claire, there isn't a whole lot of attorneys that handle that kind of case, even though there are a lot of adoptions and Lutheran Social Services is the one who handles a lot of it.
I thought one of your points was that you would not object to having a mentor slash lawyer assigned to you. In fact, I thought there was even the name that you suggested.
Yes, John Jokula.
Yes.
He doesn't practice immigration or adoption law. But I've known Mr. Jokula for a long time. Actually, I first met him when I first started having my problem. There was a group called Lawyers for Lawyers, and they got together and they tried to help each other, and he was in that group. So I have known him for 15 years. And a lot of times I will go to him and I will ask him questions. And we have a very good relationship, and he said that he would be willing to help me anytime I wanted help. He said he'd be willing to give quarterly reports if that's what was needed. He's been a long-time attorney. I'm not sure how long he has been, but I have a very good relationship with him.
In Eau Claire?
He's in Eau Claire, yes, he is. And I've worked with Judge Barland. I was a clerk for the judges in Eau Claire, so I know a lot of the judges. With this group, Lawyers Helping Lawyers, there are several lawyers in that group that I have worked with also. But Mr. Jokula is the one who came, testified for me, and said that he would be willing to assist me if I needed any assistance.
Now, do you think that the fact that you had two tests that showed codeine is enough to keep you out?
No, especially since I have a valid prescription for the medication, and I'm hoping
was that before the referee?
Pardon?
Was the fact that you had had this medication before the referee?
Yes, it was. The problem was the woman from WISLAP. I don't know how it worked. For some reason, she did not get I don't know when she requested the information, but she didn't get the information by the time of the hearing. However, at the date of the hearing, I had a copy of my prescription, and I did give it to the court. I think it is good to note that they're not saying, there's no argument that it was a high quality quantity of medication. It's just that it appeared in my test. And also, the tests I took voluntarily. In fact, I was wanting tests that would show a longer portion of time that I hadn't had any medications. My hair is 29 inches long, and it should show that I have not had any alcohol or other drugs in 7 years. However, that's not the way they tested it, and it was actually through one of the CLE classes I found out that I could have had tests to show that I had been alcohol and drug-free for a longer period of time. But
what about the concept, which I think runs through this somewhat, that you are deep in debt from the last hearings or procedures you had, and that you don't seem to have the wherewithal to pay the cost of this proceeding, which is $18,000, if I've got it right, I mean, at last count, and that renders an issue of anyone who's so deep in debt might succumb to temptation if they don't have any money, and then get money from somebody that really is owed to the client, et cetera. You don't understand the kind of argument.
Yes,
I
understand.
Suggesting.
I guess my comment to that would be, this proceeding in itself is very stressful. And if I was going to succumb to going back to my drinking and drugs, I didn't use drugs, but drinking, it would have been during this process, because it is very stressful. I think that the cost is one thing that I also wanted to address, in that part of the cost that I was assessed was attorney's fees. And my argument is that attorney's fees are not part of costs. Attorney's fees are something separate. And under the Supreme Court rules, if it's not specifically stated in the Supreme Court rules, you go back to the rules of civil procedure. And the rules of civil procedure, 814.04, discusses attorney's fees. And they said that attorney's fees should be $500, but not more than $1,000. That's 814.04 items of cost. And I think that if you look at the attorney's fees as being such a large portion of what is owed, that if those were brought in line to what they should be, then the amount owed would be quite a bit less. In addition, the reason I'm able to pay so little is because, as I said, if you have a, if your license is revoked for medical incapacity, it's very hard to find a job. Obviously, if I started working as an attorney, I would be making much more money, and it would be easier for me to pay down whatever debt that I have. But I have been making payments. I've discussed, I've worked with OLR, and they came up with a payment plan that I have been stuck to since.
You may finish your sentence, okay. And then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay, since they came up with the payment plan. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Arnold, representing the OLR.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. As has been indicated, my name is Wayne Arnold. I'm retained counsel for OLR, and I'm from Rice Lake. OLR did not ask for oral argument, and it's not our wish to add to anyone's discomfort. I would highlight to the court the written post-hearing argument of OLR. That's at record 161. That has citations to the record and to the hearing transcripts. We would recommend that to the court. Also, OLR's brief, which incorporates as an appendix the referee reports, and we would recommend that as well. At this point, I was intending to solicit questions. A couple of things Ms. Schlieve said seemed to require some response by this litigator anyway. She was complaining about the delay in the proceeding, and a good part of the delay was at her request because she wanted to demonstrate a period of monitoring by WISLAP, which ordinarily is a year. And she started with WISLAP, signed a year contract, and then ended it on her own after 2 months, claiming she didn't have money for the testing, and yet she had just recently returned from a vacation in Mexico. So then there was a period where she wasn't being monitored, and then she signed another annual contract with WISLAP, again contemplating a year's monitoring, and that ended in 2 months. So the only time she's been monitored by WISLAP are two disconnected two-month periods of time. And it's during that monitoring period when her two positive tests for codeine were developed. So the delay really was waiting for the WISLAP monitoring to be concluded, and it never was. And in fact, ultimately, Ms. Schlieve was discharged by WISLAP, and they won't take her back. And in fact, Ms. Albert described Ms. Schlieve as the 1% in the 1% worst category of clients she's ever had to deal with.
Do you want to tell us a little in terms of detail as to why that would be stated?
Well, when she would appear for, there's a number of different examples. When she would appear for testing, she would start cross-examining the people who are doing the test. Why are you doing it this way? Why are you doing it that way? I want to bring my own scissors for cutting. And the people at the testing site weren't used to that and were calling Linda Albert about it. In fact, Linda Albert kept her personally as Linda's own client because she felt that the other staff members of WISLAP would be unable to handle her. And so she was, Ms. Albert was constantly having to redirect Ms. Schlieve as to how to behave at the testing site. Ms. Schlieve was being constantly confrontational in what is a voluntary process. In other words, you go to WISLAP voluntarily to demonstrate that you're doing okay on the addiction front. And so there's just, it was very difficult personal interactions between Ms. Schlieve and the testing sites and Ms. Albert in general. And it got so bad that finally Ms. Albert terminated her from the program in the end. Does that answer your question, Justice Crooks?
Yes. Helpful. Thank you.
She was suspended for a medical disability, and the medical disability was alcoholism. Has there been any proof that during this long period of time she is using alcohol?
No.
All right. No. So you're not disputing that she says the disability for which she was suspended is in at least in remission?
As to alcohol, correct.
Are you, I'm sorry, Justice Brasso.
Ms. Schlieve makes a, I think, certainly a reasonable presentation here today. She seems to be articulate. She has a substantial brief. Are you representing to us that the appearance she has made recently in other situations is different from the appearance she's making today?
I would suggest you look at the portions of the referee report dealing, describing her interactions with the Eau Claire City Attorney's Office. You know, in some sense, it is a little bit of a catch-22 of demonstrating one's ability to practice law when you don't have a license.
Do what?
It is somewhat difficult, in a sense, to demonstrate one can practice law if you don't have a license. And so, but I think it's an interesting window into her legal soul, if you will. She had a number of insignificant, in and of themselves, ordinance violations dealing with a rental property in Eau Claire. And they were prosecuted by the Eau Claire City Attorney's Office. They involved minor matters like railings and other building details. But as you'll see in the referee's report and also in OLR's brief with citations to the record and also our post-hearing argument at Record 161, the city attorney's office responded to the public notice in the Eau Claire newspaper giving notice that Ms. Schlieve had applied for reinstatement. And they were so negatively moved by her behavior with them that they responded to that public notice and ultimately testified at the hearing and gave examples of how they described her as being dishonest and unprofessional and backdating documents. And
As I recall, there's one letter that was focused on in terms of backdating documents. My recollection is that a letter was indicated to be sent on a certain date, and the city attorney didn't believe it. The city attorney testified he was quite confident the letter of September 5th, 2005 had never been sent. So you're giving us some generalities. Give us some specifics.
I think the best understanding of that is set forth in, again, our post-hearing argument with citations to the record. It was a number of interactions about where she wanted to have an adjournment of an initial appearance on a citation. They would give her an adjourned initial appearance date. She failed to appear at the adjourned date, was defaulted. Then she moved to reopen, claiming that she never got notice of the adjourned date, even though it was sent to her by regular mail, by email, and by fax. And that happened on several occasions. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Are you done?
I was going to say the city attorney testified that he had never been motivated to respond to somebody's petition for reinstatement before in the Eau Claire area other than Ms. Schlieve and her behavior. His observations of her professional or unprofessional behavior was such that he was motivated to respond.
Tell you what's bothering me. You've got a medical incapacity by alcoholism, and that, under this record, is now satisfied. That is, that incapacity is gone, right?
Yes.
So the question is, to me, when the incapacitative mode is gone, what do you have to do to show you can get a license again?
Well, it's a two-part test, as you know. It's removal of the medical incapacity.
Right, and we've got that for the moment.
Fitness to practice law.
Right. Okay. Now, so you've got a removal of the incapacity here, and no one's disputing that except the concept that it may have been substituted with a different drug. Okay. So then my question on that issue is, would, if we just had this two-drug test, that is two tests showing codeine, right? If we just had that, is that enough to keep her out?
On the medical capacity
portion
of the test?
Yes.
I would say yes, because Linda Albert of Wislap says she is not in a position to state that someone has demonstrated a freedom from addictive substances until they've had a 12-month period of clean tests.
What does the referee say?
Contractual period. And since Ms. Schlieve's only had two disconnected 2-month periods, neither of which were clean, Ms. Albert could not state in her professional opinion that she was free of a medical incapacity.
Is that what the referee said?
Referee waffled on that. He said he found her unfit, and as a result of finding her unfit, he let go making a definitive finding.
That's what I thought. Okay, so now the next issue then. So we have a referee doesn't make a definitive finding. We have testimony that from Ms. Albert. We have testimony that two tests within 2 months and no clean tests for a year period or whatever. We don't have it. The record is not good enough. All right. The second part of the test is fitness, right?
Right.
And so if we had a practicing lawyer who for whatever reason, underwent drug tests, and they found traces of codeine in two, would that lawyer be suspended as a medical incapacity? Or if you had a graduate from one of the law schools, and for whatever reason the person was picked up for a driving offense and tested, and was not convicted of drunk driving, but there are traces of codeine in two tests, maybe four because they take it. Is that enough to keep him out when he applies on good moral character?
I think Ms. Schlieve's status here is different from the attorney who is practicing and has a dirty test. She has the burden of because of her past suspension, she has the burden of proving by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that she is free from any medical incapacity. And in the course of attempting to demonstrate that, she produced two positive codeine tests. Under that scenario, I would argue that she has not met her burden.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't get the feeling that that's what the referee did. Didn't go to the codeine test. Referee found under everything else, the backdating, the city attorney, the lack of funds, the large debts, that all of that added up together made unfit for practice. And the way I read Schlieve's brief, she's saying, hey, how can you have one test for me coming back in and another test for the person graduating law school that has the same problems I had, or a lawyer who's practicing next door in Eau Claire and has these same problems, and he's gone his merry way. Maybe you've publicly reprimanded him or something, but you're not kicking him out, and you're kicking me out. That bothers me.
Well, I confess ignorance as to exactly what the standards are for fitness for attorneys being admitted before the Supreme Court, like, for instance, recent law grads.
Mm-hmm.
I can't comment on how that might differ from a medical incapacity petition for reinstatement.
We have people coming in who obviously have alcohol problems. Now, whether they're addicted or whether they are not, but they have been arrested several times, whether for driving or disorderly conduct or underage or whatever you have, and they're coming in, sometimes under some kind of mentorship, other times not, on the theory that they've managed to control whatever it is that's caused this drinking. And others don't get in because there are line drawings. But it bothers me that you get somebody out on a medical incapacity, and then that's cleaned up. You have two drug tests. They bother me. I mean, I'm concerned. But that's far from proof of illicit drug use.
Counselor, was there any?
I'm sorry, I'm not done. Did he bring in? Did she bring in the prescriptions that showed that she may have taken codeine?
No. To the last part of your question, when she tested positive the second time, Wislap then tried to get requested her medical records from her personal physician, who she was describing earlier. And she had withdrawn
mm-hmm.
her medical release, which is contrary to the rules. If you apply for reinstatement on a medical incapacity, per rule, you have to give releases automatically on all of your as pertained to all of your medical providers. She canceled that. And then when they tried to get, when they confronted her and said, you've just canceled your medical release, which, you know, you can't do as part of this process, she then had, she gave the doctor a limited release in favor of Wislap, saying that he had written her a prescription containing codeine. But then the referee asked her during the hearing, did you have that prescription prior to testing positive for codeine, and she wouldn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
Twice, he asked her twice that mm-hmm. obvious and pointed question, and she refused to answer or ducked it.
Counselor, it seems to me that a lot of what the referee talked about were other types of conduct, being very feisty, being hard to get along with, being confrontational at times when that might not have been appropriate. Was there any testimony presented about a characteristic called a dry drunk that alcoholics sometimes display when they're still in recovery from their illness?
No, there was no discussion of that.
Okay.
Counsel, I take it you're finished, Justice Rogers.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Counsel, the argument was advanced here, and as I recall, when Ms. Schlieve was previously before the court, also advanced regarding the lack of authority to impose attorney's fees as part of costs. Can you respond to that argument, please?
To me, it's obvious that counsel fees, whether it's staff or whether it's a retained counsel, are assessable costs and have been for every case that you administer. And so when somebody suggests that they're not, I'm completely nonplussed by that argument. I don't understand it. I assume it's somebody with, you know, considerable ignorance of the system.
I'm looking at Chapter 22.01, sub 3. Costs mean the compensation and necessary expenses of referees, fees, and expenses of counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Is that what you're saying is
yes.
obvious?
Yes. Well, also, the referee made a written recommendation on costs, and I can't give you a record index number because it was generated after my record index was provided by the clerk's office. But it's one of the latter documents in the court file. This is dated July 8, 2014, and the referee really addresses Ms. Schlieve's objections to costs and, in fact, cites what you just cited. Among other things, she also claimed that OLR was incompetent and Ms. Albert was incompetent. And, you know, that just gets into a transference of responsibility or fault-finding with anybody who doesn't agree with her. And, I think that bodes poorly if she should be reinstated and you're among the practicing bar or judiciary in Eau Claire County. I would recommend to the court the referee's recommendation on costs. It goes into some detail. It's 4 or 5 pages, dated July 8th, and I do not have a record citation for it. Any other questions? You know, this is an unhappy sort of thing to be up here doing on my part. It's my personal assessment that the referee approached this with approving her petition in mind and trying to fashion some sort of conditions by which she might be admitted back to the practice. And he was continually, my assessment was, he was continually trying to do that and trying to accomplish that in some fashion, but ultimately he just gave up.
Well, what about the suggestion of appointing a lawyer as a mentor and a kind of supervisor? We've done that, and there's provisions with BBE. You can admit a lawyer conditionally as to fit various requirements, including monitoring.
It's problematic for an attorney who does not recognize they have deficiencies. If somebody denies they have any deficiencies and tends to blame others for whatever problems there are, they lack the insight then to get some assistance. I think mentors help when an otherwise good lawyer is maybe deficient in a particular area, like maybe they're weak on accounting or they haven't had a lot of experience in cross-examining a medical expert. That, you know, you can mentor somebody, and it takes. I'm not being sarcastic, but in my view, a mentor that would protect the public in Ms. Schlieve's case would have to do all of her legal work for her, A, and B, do all of the interactions with the court system. That's harsh, I realize, but that is the opinion developed from long experience in the case. Any other questions? I'll sit down early.
Justice Prosser.
Mr. Arnold, Ms. Schlieve has mentioned that she'd be interested in practicing adoption law and immigration law. What is your assessment of her ability to do that?
I'm not aware that she ever did immigration law during the short period of time when she practiced there. I think was it 6-7 years early on. She has not practiced for 17 years. That's really an existential question I just can't really handle. She means well. I think she wants, you know, she obviously wants her license back. She's sincere about that. But practicing law is hard, and it's getting harder as time goes on. And, you know, not everybody's cut out for it. Although I would be the first to acknowledge, you know, lawyers come in a whole variety of competencies or lack thereof. They represent, you know, a broad spectrum of the human condition. But, you know, as sympathetic as we might be to Ms. Schlieve, there's also the public to be protected, and I guess my job is to focus on that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Schlieve.
I would like to make a few points, and I would request that the court look over our briefs again. Mr. Arnold made a couple of points that were incorrect. First, he stated that I signed a year contract with WSLAP. There was no time limit of WSLAP. It was not a year. In fact, I was told it was significantly less.
Did you sign any contract?
Yes, I did. It should be in the record.
All right.
And in the contract, what it says is that I am supposed to have a monitor in Eau Claire. And although OLR suggests that because of my attitude, Linda took me as her own, in fact, she did it before I had even spoken to anyone. She did not give me the Mr. Jokala, who worked with WSLAP, who said he'd be my monitor, would have been the perfect monitor. Instead, she violated the terms of the contract and had me as her monitored me on her own. Linda Albert is a social worker. She's not a licensed AODA specialist. And so the discussion of me violating a year contract is untrue. As for the Eau Claire City Attorney's Office, if you look back at what they're discussing, it was 7 years ago that the whole, most of it occurred. And the backdating was because of a fax machine. If you look at it, it's the fax machine date on it. I don't know how to date a fax machine. So that was not something that I had done on purpose. The most recent interaction I had with the city attorney, I asked them to give me a different date as I was going to India. I told them the date I was going to India. I went to India to work with disabled children, and they scheduled me for the day they knew I was going to be in India. So that was my dealing with the Eau Claire City Attorney recently. The other was 7 years earlier. And I think if you look at old cases, that we don't look at 7 years ago. In some cases, people 7 years ago, they were in prison for having delivered heroin. So it's, am I fit now, not what was going on 7 years ago.
Counsel, you were making an argument with regard to lack of authority to assess attorney's fees as costs, and you cited 814. What about Chapter 22 and the specific authority to impose attorney's fees as costs? How do you deal with that?
I don't have 22 in front of me.
Tear it up. Let me just read it
okay.
to you, if I may. My concern is this. I know you advanced this argument previously that there wasn't authority to impose attorney's fees. The referee made reference to SCR 22. Previously, we've imposed attorney's fees. SCR 22.001 is the definition section, and it defines in sub 3 costs. Costs mean the compensation and necessary expenses of referees, fees, and expenses of counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Fees and expenses of counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation, I understand to mean attorney's fees. So I'm concerned, and you've got to help me on this because it raises a concern for me. I'm concerned that you're here arguing the same thing that you argued a number of years ago and telling us there is no authority when, from my perspective, there's quite clear authority to do it. So, you know, am I misreading the authority? Have you overlooked the authority, even though it's been brought to your attention? This all goes to the issue of fitness of practicing law. So just help me with that. Explain to me why you're here saying there's no authority.
There is a specific case, and I do not have it with me, that says, that discusses the ability to submit attorney's fees.
I think those were the cases that you cited previously
could be.
When attorney's fees were not allowed to be assessed.
I think that when they're talking about fees, they're talking about things that OLR is putting out, like paying for the newspaper, paying for the court reporter, paying for the room, all of those things. The attorney for OLR is the attorney no matter what. I mean, he is working for OLR. As an attorney, I paid into it. I was a member of the bar, and part of my fees went to OLR. So, in fact, I was paying the OLR attorney's fees. I think that if you look at, and I have a list of cases in the last 15 years of people who were readmitted and what their costs were. The two costs that would be equivalent in my case would be Chavez and Kirshner. In Kirshner, they did not impose any fees. In Chavez, the total amount of cost was $2,604.06. And so either, I don't know that his was, mine was eight times harder to work on than his. But I think that if you look at what was ordered in these cases, attorney's fees, they come about when OLR is trying to punish the attorney. And I think that I wish I had that case that I had suggested that regarding attorney's fees. It is a way to make, if you want attorneys to come back in and get their license back, and then you say, yeah, but you owe $24,000 of attorney's fees, that's trying to keep them out. That's trying to keep them from coming back and requesting that they have their get their license back. And I would like to, I don't know who to give these this list of.
The marshal will take that from you, Ms. Schlieve. And first of all, would you give one to Mr. Arnold? Mr. Arnold, do you have any objection?
What came up? And all of these are reasonable.
Please, you too. Do you have any objection, Mr. Arnold, for this being passed out to the court, this list that you just got? No objection. Fine. Your red light is on, ma'am, so you have a couple of seconds just to sum up. Please.
And In summary, I would like to say that I have met my burden. I have, my medical incapacity has been overcome, and it no longer exists, and that I am fit to practice law, and I would request that my license be reinstated. If the court finds that a mentor or there are some conditions that needed to be placed on, I'd be more than willing to work with whatever conditions the court deems necessary.
Chief Justice Gableman. I have some questions, Ms. Levy, that arose from Attorney Arnold's argument, and there are three brief questions, but I would like them responded to. Is it true that what he said, that you gave a limited release to your physician in regard to the prescription for codeine so that the physician was authorized to indicate that a prescription for codeine had been given, but the dates were redacted?
No. What happened was Ms. Arnold said that I was no longer going to be part of WSLAP, the WSLAP program, and at that point, I withdrew my my authorization. She knew that I had this prescription since October. So
were any prescriptions provided? Were any prescriptions provided to WSLAP?
Yes.
Did they contain dates?
I don't know what they contained, but I didn't. I never said don't tell what dates because obviously they needed to know.
I beg your pardon, ma'am?
I don't have any knowledge of what it contained, but in my, I never asked not to have dates.
Did you, is it true what Mr. Arnold said, that twice the referee asked you about your use of codeine or any other kind of prohibited substance, and twice you declined to answer?
No, that is not true.
You weren't asked about that?
I told him that I had a valid prescription. And I gave him a copy.
Did that copy contain dates?
Yes, yes.
And that's in the record?
Yes.
And finally, this seems like a small point, but it struck my attention. Mr. Arnold made a he indicated that at some point you wanted to bring your own scissors to the test. Is that true?
Actually, it was at the suggestion of Linda Albert. When you do a hair test, they take it, well, they were taking three chunks of hair from me, and it was more than they needed. She suggested that we use a thinning scissors, and she suggested that I bring a thinning scissors. It was at her suggestion. It was later that I found out that there didn't need to be three tests. They only needed to take it from one place because I have so much hair. So.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Levy. That ends our hearing in OLR versus Levy. The court is always concerned on any of these cases relating to lawyer regulation. And Ms. Levy, thank you for appearing and arguing. And Mr. Arnold, same to you. This concludes our hearing in 1997 AP 3862D OLR versus Nancy H. Levy. The court will take a few moments in recess while these students leave and others come in, and that these counsel leave and others come in. We're in recess.